Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country.
You brothers are lucky because you got to sneak into this, but we're happy to have you.
I remember there were kids around my neighborhood would say, "Oh, you talk funny. You talk like a white girl."
And the China is the Eisenhower goal, China. You see, so many of the beautiful old services the president's had were destroyed and broken. So now the Truman and the Eisenhower China is all that there's enough left of to use. And there is the beautiful Monroe centerpiece and his flower or fruit baskets and candelabra, all brought from France in 1817. And these glasses, they're ours. I wanted a very simple design so that the china and silver and glass would show up more. So I looked all over, and the prettiest ones I found came from West Virginia.
A law was made a distant moon ago here.
It is Camelot. Actually, it's Jackie O versus Michelle O, part two on The Savage Nation, as well as her husband, Obama the Globalist. Now that he's solved the problems of the world of America, and he's made sure there's a chicken in every pot and pot in every chicken in America, he's on to the London stage. The old Vic, where he's going to try to put a chicken in every pot and some pot in every chicken in India, China, Pakistan, and Africa. And I'm going to talk about these topics today in the Savage Nation because they're worth talking about. I mean, the globalist guy is there. We knew he was a neo-Marxist, but today we found out there's more to it than meets the eye. And we're going to talk about what Mr. O did in London. I mean, I don't have it in for the guy. I actually watched him and wished him well. I hope he does well. I want to believe in him, truthfully. I'm an idealist at heart. And I look at the guy, and I know he's a human being, but I don't trust him. Everything I see about him tells me, watch out. Now, I felt the same way about George Bush, Richard Nixon, LBJ, Barney Frank, the local dog catcher. So it's not that Obama's in a separate league. He's a politician, for God's sakes. If police chiefs in big cities will stab cops in the back for doing their job, why shouldn't presidents stab the military in the back for doing their job? You have to ask yourself. It's the same mentality. So I'm going to talk about these things today, but I'm tell you what I'm really going to talk about. Actually, not really. I mean, I'm going to tell you what else I'm going to talk about, which is what I'm interested in. And I'll tell you why I'm going to do it, because if I'm interested in it, I found out you're interested in it. I want to go to something new. It's quick. Remember my continuing correspondence with a big shot magazine writer who wants to fly to San Francisco to interview me? And we talked about it about a week ago, and I said, should I or shouldn't I submit myself to the interview? Well, I got to read you what came in over the last few days, those of you who called in on this. And I'll begin with the last couple of responses. I said to him at one point, I said, remember now, it's a big magazine. This is something everybody wants to have done, which is kind of a biography profile. And you all hope it's complimentary, but often it isn't, particularly if you're a conservative. They try to turn you into something that you're not. So I finally sent him a note and I said, what is your orientation here? What is it you're after? Every other journalist, London Times, etc., told me they'd be fair. They never mentioned my 20 books, my ethnobotanical research, my grants to Marines and cops. All they wrote about was their own biases. How can I help you? And then he wrote this back, and he said, I understand completely. I've been doing this long enough to know you can't promise anyone that they'll like what you write about them. But I can say that I have no interest in writing a story that reads like an expose. That's been done anyway. Reporters sometimes act as if your expertise in herbal medicine and your upbringing in the Bronx were deep, dark secrets, even though you regularly talk about both on the air. So, I mean, the guy has a, you know, he, at least he listens to the show. And he say, he goes on. So I said, well, let's email for a bit. And I said, I've been lied to and set up before, most notably every magazine and newspaper writer who I've ever been befriended. I guess I'm just a trusting personality who wants to believe in people. And he said, obviously a journalist promising to be fair is a bit like a doctor promising to be gentle. It sounds good, but it doesn't mean much. But I will say that I've got no interest in writing one of those pieces that's all about whether some outspoken person is good or bad or hateful or whatever. Like I said, that's been done more than once. So then we go on. And on and on. And I remember I went on the air and I said, why don't we do this on the air? Here's what he wrote to me. He said, wow, I just listened to last week's show. It was fun and slightly disorienting, like being in a sci-fi movie. Suddenly, I've been sucked through the speakers and into the radio. Now, remember what you're listening to here. I'm Michael Savage, nationally famous talk show host, on the air for 15 years, celebrated last week, author of 25 books. I am being approached by a mainstream big magazine reporter who wants to do a profile of me. I'm leery of it for what's been done to me. Okay? So he says, anyway, I was glad to hear that you're still considering it, and I thought your listeners made some pretty good arguments on both sides. Listen to this now. He says, what Dane from Florida said was smart. I love the idea of someone interviewing you on the radio, though I don't think I'm the right person to do it. There's a reason I sit behind a computer instead of sitting behind a microphone. Besides, I don't really want to make this about me. I want to write about your show as a listener, not a participant. And I think Mike from Las Vegas nailed it when he said, you don't need it, Mike. Of course you don't. You've already built your career a few times over. That's why I think you can afford to give this a shot if you feel like it. This is the writer to me. What I'm after, by the way, is two things. I want to watch you do your show, if you'd allow that, and I want to talk to you about your life. Is there any chance that could happen? So I waited a few days, and I was in a pissed-off mood, as usual. I had a headache. I don't know what it was. I just didn't feel good. So I sent him this note, and I said, the cartoon that goes with the story, will it show me in the Gestapo or an SA uniform? Surely you don't believe I don't know what you want to try to make of me. Why must everyone in journalism be so obvious? Why must all of you in the extreme media paint everyone you disagree with as demonic? Why is the homosexual agenda so important to the midstream media? The San Francisco Chronicle, once a decent average newspaper, is now defunct, largely because of the above attitudes I sent to him. So then he sends me another one. I don't even know where it is. It's a good one. Oh, here it is. He says, this came today. He says, well, I can certainly understand why you mistrust the mainstream or midstream media, including this magazine. Now, listen carefully. He says, all I can say is that I've got no interest in writing why Savage is evil or whatever. Sounds boring and stupid. I hate stories like that. The story I want to write isn't primarily about politics. Listen to this carefully. In fact, if all you talked about was politics, I probably wouldn't even be interested in writing about you, Savage. In my view, a big part of what makes Savage unique is the wide range of topics you talk about and write about, especially in psychological nudity. In 10 minutes, the topic might shift from the G20 summit to Cuban food to frog legs to your dog, Teddy. The person who can do all that and do it every day is a person worth reading about. The other day you said you had a kaleidoscopic mind, which seems like a pretty good description. That's a story I haven't read before, and that's the story I want to tell. That's why I was hoping to talk to you in person. I can well understand if you'd rather not. It's not like you need the press coverage, but hey, I figure I might as well ask again, right? Now, I got to tell you, so when I read this today, because he heard the show, I said, you know what? Here's what I'm going to write him. Now, listen carefully. He says to me, I sent him this. I said, you can talk to me in person. Okay. I'm interested in literature and writers. I will be bliss work. The only thing I cannot do is invite you into one of my radio studios. It throws me off when I perform for a visitor. Better to stay grumpy and alone and see what my friends inside my mind want to say. Yesterday, for example, yesterday was a good example of the stream of consciousness process. I began by comparing Jackie Onassis Kennedy and Michelle Obama and moved into Ruthie Madoff, Hillary's bowling pin shape, camouflaged by a friendly press, artifacts I bought at a remnant store, which included a life ring from HMS Sheffield and the story of that ship sinking by the Argentines during the Falklands War. Who in Argentina may have found the life ring, on which beach, and how it got to a used furniture store in Florida. It was a radio classic. And that's where it left off. Now, I mean, I realize this is not what you tune in for. At least most of you don't. You want to do hard politics day in and day out. I can do it, you know. I can do it and I cannot do it. Meanwhile, I'm doing this because this is also, you know, something to do with it, you know. Now, if you want to talk about this and tell me whether or not I should do this interview, call me at 1-800-449-8255. We will talk about BO at the G20 summit. You know, I'm not going to make a big deal about Michelle hugging the Queen. Please don't call me about it. That's childish. I'll tell you why. What, you can't touch her? You want to hear my take when I heard she touched the Queen and she broke protocol? I said, hey, the Queen probably hasn't been touched in 70 years. It probably turned her on. She's probably going to run off with a Jamaican from Brixton. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Savage Nation, topics you know. Here's a new story. Feds just indicted ex-Governor Blagojevich, including his brother, and five aides. Really an amazing story. I mean, you read about the guys indicted with him. William F. Cellini Sr. Have you got any of the music to go with it? They indicted Blagojevich, right? Chris Kelly of Burridge, because we don't have Irish music, so we haven't. Then they also indicted William F. Cellini Sr., 74, of Springfield, who raised significant funds for Blagojevich, in part through his role as the executive director of the Illinois Asphalt Pavement Association. This gold telephone from our friends. Blagojevich is accused of plotting to trade or sell President Obama's former U.S. Senate seat. Schmuck got caught. Blagojevich is out of town when the indictment was filed. He's in Orlando, Florida, staying at the Saratoga Springs Resort and Spa in Lake Buena Vista. Wow. He plans to take his wife and two daughters to Disney World. No one answered calls to the room where Blagojevich was registered. I hate to be him. This is bad. I mean, this guy's going to go after him. This guy down there, he really wants him. All right, let's go back to the callers. How about Michelle touching the Queen? You heard my take on it. Big deal. Right? Should I do the interview with the major stream reporters or not? Yes or no? Yes, no, no, yes. Yes, no. Really, come on. The guy is intelligent. I'm a sucker for brains in that sense. Even if he hates me, he's intelligent. I told him already. I don't want to hear anything about the agenda. Okay, do something interesting. You caught the kaleidoscopic mind. You understood the whole mix between Hillary's hips and whatever, and the frog's leg. You see what I mean? How stream of consciousness works. Yesterday I was talking about frog's legs and a dog's leg, and then Hillary's fat thighs. Don't you remember yesterday? If you listen every day to the ongoing Michael Savage serial. There must be an audience for this. I mean, my ratings are humongous. They're growing. The audience is bigger. And since you know my political orientation, I can get away with anything I want, which is letting you inside my shop, which is between my ears. Isn't it horrible how this works? All day long, I'm miserable. 21 hours a day, I live in misery. 3 hours a day, I'm happy. I'm on the radio. I can exercise my mind. 21, I can't take humdrum. I actually like crisis. I probably should have gone into the military as a child and stayed in it the rest of my life and been in war, one war after another, and died at 30, like Alexander the Great. I mean, probably there's something to be said for it. I mean, because living in an ordinary life is horrible. That's why a lot of men come home from battle, they don't know what to do with themselves. It's horrendous. You know, really, it's awful every day, dealing with the garbage and the water and the bagel. Did he get the right bagel? Does it have a tint of sugar in it? Did it have any dairy in the bagel? You go crazy. You go out of your bloody mind. Jerry in Montana, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'd like to ask you if you've asked your wife as far as the interview.
Oh, you brought up the boss, huh?
Yes, sir.
She immediately said, oh, she doesn't trust this guy from a mile away.
Neither. Take her advice.
No, here's what I said to her. Well, she doesn't trust many people, let's put it to you that way. But she said to me, she's smart, okay? She's the smartest woman I know. So she says to me, she said, haven't you learned from experience yet? She said, the guy flew out from the London Times. He sounded just as literate, just as intelligent, just as friendly. And the minute you took him to dinner at Aliotto's, and I remember to this day, and we had dinner, He turned on me in the middle of the dinner. He looked like like horns came out of his head. We were having a great time. All of a sudden, he turned on me and he said, "Why do you care about the noise in this restaurant? Does it upset you?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And like he wrote this article about how evil I am because I didn't like noise in a restaurant. It indicated a war personality. No, I swear, Jerry, I swear to God, I forgot that article, this creep from the London Times. All it was about was homosexuals. Can't they let it go already? I mean, can't they stop already? I pray to God this reporter's not gay. That's all I pray. Or if he is gay, I hope to God he's happily married.
Good. Well, I would take your wife's advice. I heard her on the radio when you had her.
Don't fall for the nice sweetness and light because we were listening to, you know, we had an audience.
Well, now you say you're happy.
You don't want to hear about, you don't want to hear about her when the meatloaf is flying. All right, look, I don't know. I won't take her advice. I always make that mistake. Chicago, it's amazing. I mean, people are calling about this. Not from any real cities. They're calling, like, from Pahrump, Nevada. The big cities hung up already on this. They already tuned into Obama's no good. He's a globalist. He's going to take us over. He's like Angela Davis, the Afro cartoon from The New Yorker was correct. How dare you talk about anything but how bad Obama is every second of the day. Wrap yourself in the flag, please. If I had to do that every day, I'd take the gas pipe. I'd turn the gas on and I wouldn't leave the kitchen. Come on. You got to understand. What about the touching? How about the touching of the queen? Is that a big deal? I mean, that's a thing. I mean, she hugged the queen. I guess she got overwhelmed by it, you know. She, like a kid, you know, grew up, minority girl, goes to Yale, man, president. I mean, it is kind of awesome for her, so she don't know what to do at a certain point. What would you do if you suddenly landed there in England? You'd be awestruck. You'd say, all right, hug her. Look at the old bit. I mean, the woman's like 4'3". Michelle's 5'9", or whatever. She felt bad for her, little old lady. I mean, she's 109? How old is this queen? 90? I don't know. Why do they live to 100? Mrs. Savage, by the way, said to me, how come they all live to 103? I said, how come? They don't do anything all day but collect drug money. I mean, money comes in from around the world. The British Empire was built on pillage, the opium trade. What do you think, things have changed?
Savage.
Tunisia, listen to this piece. I mean, it transports you to Tunisia in your mind, right? That's art. Every time I used to hear this as a kid, it would take me out of geometry, you know. That's why it was so subversive. It's like my father, why are you listening to that evil music? He knew, don't worry. He knew it would prevent me from becoming a dentist. Whatever. I'd probably be dead by now. If I had actually become a dentist to play the accordion, dead already. 49 top, a blowout. 6 feet under. But, you know, there's a lot of fire in my blood. Must be some gypsy in my blood, too. Who knows? You know, you go to Europe, you think you know with the pogroms and the invasions and the villages and the fights and the swords. You know who what? 500 years ago went on into the gene pool. Whoever it was, man, I thank him for that wild gene. I've always been different than everyone. Oh, God. You try that. All right, anyway, I could play it all day, but that's Dizzy Gillespie, Night in Tunisia. Try that with your top down in a convertible on a quiet country road at night and see if the rabbits don't get scared. Now, let's play something. You want to hear something disorienting? Go from that now to Jackie Onassis' voice.
All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years.
Now, Jackie Onassis Kennedy's voice is disorienting. It's an obvious girly act. I mean, come on, this girl was as smart as they come. You know, JFK, you know, whatever. Frank Sinatra, allegedly, a few. And then Onassis, right, the toad-like Greek shipping magnate. But if you listen to her voice, it's like a Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice thrown in, like female Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice, right? You know, you know, right? Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice. I like when she says "Chiner," this Chiner. I love that. When she's talking about a piece of pottery, she's this Chiner. Now, if I said that, you'd say I'm illiterate. But Jackie Kennedy would say this Chiner came from, you know, whatever. So it was high class because she was from Hyannis Port, and I was from the lowest port in the Bronx. So what do you want from me? Same accent. She's from the Hyannis Port. I'm from the lower Hyannis Port. Whatever. What's the difference where you're from? I've told you that 1,000 times. It doesn't matter where you began. It matters where you end up. Have you figured that out yet? It doesn't matter how it begins for you. It matters how it ends for you. Because, you know, I have to tell you what that means. How many people start with everything and end up with nothing? And how many people start with nothing and end up with a lot? Now, but there's a thing that comes out of the ancient wisdom that says a man can spend his entire life building his reputation and in one careless act destroy his entire reputation. We know that. You know, you understand that, mister? You understand what that means? One careless act, meaning one mistake and you're done, particularly in our society. So, you know, life is like that. That's why I'm a fan of many different things. I love very skilled performers, but I also love, for example, martial arts. I'm not a martial artist. Mentally, I may be as adept as anyone you've ever met, but physically, it's a whole different world. These people can take punishment. It doesn't matter what their size is. There are people in the fighting professions that are built differently than you and I, and I have met them in my life. There's a different DNA code. And they can take punishment in ways you can't imagine. But the fact is not only can they take abuse, they can give abuse. However, the fact of the matter is you have to desire to do that with your body. And it doesn't mean that everyone who does it is a dummy either. Don't make that mistake. Don't assume everyone who's boxing or fighting is stupid. Please don't make that error. It's the same thing as saying everyone who's a professor is smart, okay? It's the reverse of that, you know, quotient. So you have to, you know, see the individual. I forgot already the train of thought. It's a sad thing. That's why, because I listened to the Jackie. Yo, I have a headache today. I'll tell you exactly what happened. After last night's show, I had the sore throat. I drank scotch for the sore throat, I told you. Luckily, the sore throat went away. It resolved. I have a smashing headache, though. See, that's the problem. That's life. Beautiful. Every day is another struggle. It's an awful thing. I think I'm going to take a vow of silence and join a monastery. The problem is I don't like monks. I never met a monk I liked. I met a few. You think I never met a monk? You're wrong. In Mill Valley, California, if you go over a hill, there's a Zen monastery called the Green Gulch. I don't know all of them, nor can I generalize. Every time I've gone to a certain, like an English inn that they built down there on the other side of the valley, the monks go over there. They're like bald heads with cassocks they wear, drunks. They drink like fish. And they're all, you know, loud, loudy kind of. They're basically the normal guys in a frock picking organic vegetables. I don't get that whole thing. Why do they have to do that? I mean, that's their business. You know, I said there's billions of people, there's millions of ways to live. Everyone has their own way through life. Monk. I never met a monk, really. A nice monk. Why does everyone as a monk have to be saintly? A lot of the guys aren't saintly. That's why they become monks. I mean, figure it out. They're whack jobs to go into that later on in life. Who would do that if they were having a decent life, even some troubles? They have to have troubles that you can't believe that even rehab doesn't work. The only thing left for them is to take the cloth. I better not go to that drinking establishment again. There's like darts in there and bad warm beer. I like to go there in the winter when there's no tourists. I have beer and play darts. You ever play darts? And you talk about the queen. You talk about free association. You think the queen has a dartboard somewhere in her bedroom? Hey, Beowulf, does she live with a guy that... Is that Prince Philip? I don't know if I liked him or not. Wasn't he a Nazi? No, there was an uncle that was a Hitlerite, right? Yeah. They all have the guys with the big teeth. They remind me of, I don't know, something. They're connected to the Kennedys, the ones with the big teeth over there in England. Somehow, even though Irish, English, it's the large teeth that link them up. In my mind, I said. I didn't say they're actually directly linear related in any genetic sense. But, you know, so Michelle Touch is a big deal. Gives her a hug. You think Prince Philip did her in the last 59 years? You must be joking. They live in two different castles. They have two different zip codes over there. They haven't seen each other probably for 43 years, except at functions where they serve, you know, dried codfish. So I'm sure that she loved having Michelle give her a hug. She said, wow, that's what a human being's touch feels like? Man, it's different than the Yorkie I've been touching. Ooh, sure feels different than touching a Yorkie. Not bad, man. As I say, better keep an eye on that queen after this touch, because if she starts doing drive-thrus through Brixton, you know, anything might happen. Come on, wake up out there, for God's sakes. Play your Dizzy Gillespie, Night in Tunisia, but shorter now. I'm going to cut it off after 10 seconds. Just, that's it, for a breather. It's like you need like a surgical instrument to get inside behind my eye. The only thing that will cure this is three beers right after the show. Hard to enjoy yourself in life, isn't it true? More and more. Turn it off. Have you found it's more difficult to enjoy life than it used to be? Or is it only me? Am I getting older? I want to ask you something. But, you know, I look back, I never enjoyed myself. Oh, childhood you enjoy. But do people really enjoy? I look at people, and I wonder, am I missing something? I see them do things that I can't do. Like, I see a man with his wife and three children with a sand pail and a shovel and chairs and, like, flotation devices walking to a beach. Now, I'm not knocking it. Don't get me wrong. Do they actually like building up skin cancer quotient? What is it that they like on a beach? I don't understand this part of it. And how could you stand being with your wife and children in a hot, sticky, suntan lotion-y, not enough money for even a hamburger and parking? And I mean, I'm not knocking it. I understand the best things in life are free, particularly if you can't afford anything else. Sure, the best things in life are free, yeah, if you can't afford anything else. But there are things in life that are not free. If you can afford them, they're pretty good. By the way, yeah, try Las Vegas one of these nights when no one's around. What do you mean the best things in life are free? That's written for the average person who wants to believe that malarkey. That's for downtimes like this. Oh, yeah, we'll go to the beach, honey, on Sunday. Great. I'm great, Daddy. I have the shovel and pail. Oh, man, maybe I missed that part. Or it could be that I am jaundiced because my father works 7 days a week and he never once took us to the beach. So maybe I admit. There's a little psychology at work here where, okay, I'm upset that they have a father. I don't know. I don't ever want to go. But I needn't do it with my kids, and I could have. Maybe once I took them. We all almost drowned in an undertow, so that was the end of it for me. I mean, I'm a boater. First of all, I want to tell you something about the ocean and swimming that you don't know. This is a modern phenomenon. It's only in the last 100 or so years that schmucks go in the ocean. Now it's a whole, everyone goes in, ocean, oh, one. 1890 was the beginning of this fantasy. Ocean, go in the ocean. You know how many dangers lurk in the ocean? Never mind, okay, the undertow, you know. The diseases in the ocean, the fish, the sharks, various and sundry things. Okay, well, maybe that's you, you're a chicken. No, I'm a swimmer, I could swim in the ocean, but why do it? Why subject yourself to that particular Jaws thing? You know, like, here's the thing as a man, I want to tell you, so I'm going to get off the swimming thing in the ocean. This is all free association, okay? Ever since I've been a boy, whenever I don't mind a pool. In fact, I like a pool. In fact, I love a saltwater pool. I don't like chlorine, okay? I love it. My ultimate water experience is a saltwater pool, okay? No chlorine. I don't like swimming in natural bodies of water, even in a lake, as a male, because we're built differently than a woman, but they have two things hanging down. And now that I think about it, I always have a sense that some sea creature is going to come up and boom. That's the end of the story right there. Always sensed it. Because it did happen historically. It happens right now. A guy in Africa probably, or Pakistan, he wades in the river to get that eel for dinner, and he comes back a girl. I mean, come on, man. It does happen to you. I know this is not politics. Babe, well, for you laughing on the air, I hope you are. You should be. You should let it on the air. At least someone knows. Someone finds this funny. Okay, I go back to regular programming at the risk of boring the, you know, hey, how come you're not doing what those other stations are doing right now? Why aren't you that homophobic, anti-Obama man that we've come to love? Why? Let's see. 1 in 10 Americans. Here's a regular news story now for those of you who don't want to be entertained. 1 in 10 Americans gets help from U.S. to buy food. How could this be? A record 32.2 million people, 1 in every 10 Americans, receive food stamps in the latest count. The government said, 32 million people are grifting on food stamps? That's amazing. How much do these grifters get? Let's see. Because I know there's a lot of people fake this. So, food stamps, the major U.S. anti-hunger program. Hunger. You ever see the fatsos that go in with food stamps? Help poor people. Oh, yeah, it helps poor people. I'd like to have $15 for every person with a new car that goes in. The husband's in the car with the jewelry, and the illegal aliens with the food stamps buying buy groceries. The average benefit was $112 a month in January. Oh, my heart bleeds for them. A weakened economy here. He's a do-gooder. Says, a weakened economy means that many more individuals are turning to food stamps, said the Food Research and Action Center, an anti-hunger group. You know what? Get a real job. You know, become a man. Become a lifeguard or something. Sell hot dogs at Jones Beach. Stop joining one of these fraudulent government organizations. All you want to do is help the poor. You're really helping yourself. Vermont, Alaska, and South Dakota had increases of more than 5%. Wait. Food stamp enrollment rose in 46 of the 50 states, blah, blah, blah. Which states were the most? U.S. unemployment rate was 8.1%. Wait a minute. I thought everything was better since Obama became president. Texas had the largest enrollment. It's illegal alien, Schmendrick. Of course Texas had the largest enrollment. Let me ask you something. If you were a dirt poor Mexican and you could walk across the border and get a food stamp from a do-gooder American, and yeah, I'm a citizen, yeah, gracias, amigo. Of course you'd get one. You go back to Mexico with the cheese. California, 2.5 million. Of course they're going to be high in California. Again, you swim over for a food stamp. You get the government cheese, you get the booze, and you go home. What are you talking about? San Diego John, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. Listen, I wanted to remind you again of why the things that you talk about would probably be pretty iffy if somebody tried to put it in print, and that is your mind works like Coltrane and Charlie Parker, and I was so thrilled to hear you laughing a lot today because you're playing Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah,
you cannot explain that to the common, ordinary person that's going to, I don't care how big the magazine is.
Wait, what you're saying, I could not explain what? Dizzy Gillespie?
You can't explain the level of your, you know, your genius. I mean, that's what it is. You're up there with, you know, Da Vinci and Picasso and all these cats. You cannot explain that to people.
Well, let me explain something to you. You're 100% right, and I've given up trying, and I've learned to live in my own world and by myself and play with my own toys, so to speak. This gentleman is a music critic and jazz writer. Does that help you at all in understanding why I've even engaged with him?
Well, yeah, definitely. Now, that puts another slam on.
All right, if this guy has written about music and jazz, then he can understand the complexities of a mind that's not linear, right?
Yeah, again, maybe.
Maybe. I understand that. He's only a critic. He's not, you know, he's not the horn player.
Not behind the horn. He's not behind the microphone. He's not doing the books like you sent me, you know, for the psychological.
Oh, did you get the psychological nudity?
Send that to people.
Yeah. No, it's a great book. We sold out the second printing. I'm on a third now. Yeah, it's back ordered. I don't know what to do, truthfully. I don't know one way or the other. It's not going to change my life. Let's put it to you this way before we go, John. I do the interview, and he slams me and makes me into Hitler. What's going to hurt me? Again, another one? So what? How does it hurt me?
Well, you know, it just like, again, I'd like to point out.
Well, what happens is they all quote each other. That's the funny thing. Some dirtbag from San Francisco did the same thing to me 2 years ago. Then the picture came out with me on the cover, literally spit coming out of my mouth with making me into what I'm not. After telling me he was a sweet guy, I think he was a black guy, by the way. You know, I'm your friend, nice guy, same garbage. They went to people who said they were my friends who stabbed me in the back and made stories up about me. The same garbage over and over again. Then they make believe that's a fact and suddenly appears in Wikipedia.
Just take a look at the cover of your latest book. That says it all.
What do you mean?
Well, think about it. You got this just great, you know, you got your white top hat, you got your dog. The things that matter, I mean, you know, people don't get that. They hear you on the radio, they say, this is Michael Savage? Holy cow.
What do you mean? They don't think that I look like that.
Yeah.
Well, I do disarm people all the time because they expect me to be like 6'10", you know, blue eyes and blonde hair. But I didn't wreck the world economy. I got to tell you that, John.
Exactly.
That was for you. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Well,
three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once, so he painted this picture from photographs.
Picture. Just like me, same accent. China, picture. She was a real New Yorker, even though born in Hyannis. Remember this song, Desafinado, will always bring back memory of incredible sex with a Playboy bunny. Who did this? I forgot the musicians. This is so incredibly unique. You know, Stan Getz. Stan Getz. And Charlie Parker. Charlie Bird Parker. Now picture you're a college kid with a fetal pig in your refrigerator having to memorize anatomical parts of a fetal pig by day. And at night, you're struggling to not go insane and throw yourself off the dorm roof, even though I wasn't in the dorm, if you know what I mean, from the pressures of memorizing the names of pig's entrails in Latin. And so, you know, you get into jazz clubs, Latin music, you go to the Palladium, you hear musicians that you can't believe can exist, like Jose Fajardo playing a black wooden flute, and you don't believe it. You never heard anything like that. You grow up with Ed Sullivan and Guy Lombardo or whatever. You know, I wasn't music raised or anything like that. I was like a silent house, basically. I told you my father didn't even let me put the radio on the way to work. No radio! No radio, you're going to work today. What do you mean, Dad? No radio. Why? You got to get your mind ready for work. It's not fun. See how opposite it all was to today? Today's like, oh, yeah, everything is moody. I have something for you in the next hour you're not going to believe. High school 1959 versus high school 2009. You're not going to believe it. But it's related a little bit to this on the Savage Nation. So I hope you continue listening, boys and girls, in the Savage Nation, because I'll be right back.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Nobody else but you. I want to be loved by you alone.
And this tablecloth is new. It's a gift to the White House from the firm of Porto. And it's all embroidered in gold to match the centerpeace and the knife and fork.
Each time I see a little girl of 5 or 6 or 7, I can't resist a joyous urge to smile and say thank heaven.
All little girls. Ooh. Today they'd arrest him.
All little girls get bigger
a
every day.
A Frenchie like him, an old man dancing with a cane and a top hat and spats heaven. Talking about little girls.
All little girls.
This passed for entertainment.
They grow up in the most delightful way.
He was a molester.
Those little eyes so helpless.
Oh my God, stop it. I'm getting a creepy feeling.
Flash and send you crashing through the ceiling. Thank heaven for little girls. Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do?
All right, very innocent, yeah, thank I'm sure. Heaven. Turn it off. We're playing Jackie Onassis' voice. It's very disorienting. It's an obvious girly act, but it's very disorienting. I say it's like a Midtown Manhattan cabbie voice. Like when she says China, she says China, you know, like me, like China, China where? China, this China came from, okay, she does it, it was charming. I do it, you say I'm illiterate. So, you know, it depends on why, because she was born in Hyannisport, and I was born in the lowest port of the Bronx. What are you going to do about that? You know, so, I mean, I don't want to do politics today. I'm so tired of it. We have Obama over in the G20. I watched it. I was nursing like a Scotch hangover headache today, and I watched it for about, I kind of wanted to enjoy him. I was like rooting for him. I did. I want him. But then I got scared because he did exactly what I feared. He basically was saying that he's going to subjugate American interests to world interests, by the way, incidentally. Okay, clip three. Listen to this one.
In an era of integration and interdependence, it is also my responsibility to lead America into recognizing that its interests, its fate is tied up with the larger world. That if we neglect or abandon those who are suffering in poverty, that not only are we depriving ourselves of potential opportunities for markets and economic growth, but ultimately that despair may turn to violence that turns on us.
Typical liberal claptrap. Typical liberal bullcrap. Poverty produces violence? That is utter rubbish. That's one of the liberal protocols that has produced 60 years of insanity in the United States of America. How many billions of dollars have been spent trying to end poverty in America only to have gangs proliferate like viruses in this country? And so, again, this is liberal claptrap. This is Obama the social worker, Obama the brainwashed left-winger, Obama the professor, Obama thinking now he's going to take more of your money and turn it over to Africa, Asia, whatever, and that's going to end violence. That's going to take a fanatic religious Muslim who believes in jihad, and by giving him money, he's going to not think that you as an infidel deserve to die. Are you crazy? This is what got to me. You know, if I listen to it, I really hear it. And so he says, in the era of integration, end poverty? Around the world, we're going to end poverty. How many trillions of dollars have we sent overseas? Has it ended poverty? You know what's ended poverty? India's dynamo of an economy has ended a lot of poverty in India. China, capitalism has ended more poverty in China. Capitalism has ended more poverty in China than all of the do-gooder programs in the history of the world, Mr. Obama. So there it is. Again, he's trying to say that we must subjugate our interests in the interest of the world. Who said we've ever abandoned those suffering in poverty? Well, what is he talking about? You know, so I listened to this. I didn't want to talk about it. And I didn't want to do it, but I mean, of course, I have to do it. And then he goes on to First Lady Michelle Obama visits. Oh, no, this is something else. But I don't want to make – I was rooting for him because he is the president. I'm an American. I wanted him to do well. I wasn't hoping he failed. I'm not like some of the schmucks in the media. I don't have to hope he's going to fail. I mean, the fact of the matter is this guy is over there. And if you listen to it, it's liberalism in a way that is magnified, of course. And he's toned down his Marxism for the world audience. But the subtext is neo-Marxism again. You know, to each – what? How does that Marxist the phrase go with the early Bolsheviks? To each, whatever. To each – from each according to his means, to each according to his needs. That means take from those who have and give it to have not those who don't have. That's straight out robbery and income redistribution. It's a tenet of Marxism. To each according to his means, meaning tax you to death, and for each according to his needs. In other words, the bum in the street, the crackhead, should get your money so he can go buy more crack and a new Chinese car. Are you crazy? So I didn't like it. I mean, he had a cold, Obama. And I'm a caring person. The funny thing is I've helped so many people over my life with colds and flu and illnesses from all the years I was in the alternative medical field without drugs. And not knocking drugs, they work too. But, you know, you talk about complementary medicine. He said I've been fighting this when he, like, coughed. I felt fatherly. I wanted to give him a handkerchief and a zinc lozenger and, like, an echinacea spray. But I couldn't reach out and do that. I did. My instinct was, man, someone, that, don't they know about that stuff? I mean, they're all into like health food. The guy's fighting a cold because he's in stress. He, after all, it's a big stressful job when you take over the newspapers one day, the automobile industry the day before, and the day before that, the banks. And now that you've solved the problems of America, you're going to rush off and solve the world's problems. It wears a man out, you know, in 100 days. You got there's a lot to do. You can run a guy down, even a guy in good shape with a great voice can get unique, you know, uniquely wiped out. So, but I wanted to give him like the caring father in me. I wanted to give him, come up on the stage and say, time out. My president's not feeling well. Here, Mr. President, here's a handkerchief. Here's a cherry-coated zinc lozenge. Wonderful for your throat. Don't take more than one a day. Here's, you know, an Echinacea Golden Seal spray. Take three spritzes in the back of your throat. And tonight, as soon as you're through talking to these Brits and you've eaten the rotten food over here, I want you to get into bed. I want you to take a scotch and basically hold it on the back of your throat. And I want you to go to sleep in a warm room, no air conditioning, okay? I didn't get to say that. I went to sleep myself. Play Desafinado for a minute, then I'm going to take some callers here. A little slow. All right, they don't know what I'm going to say. How could they know? Nothing's planned on this show. Nothing is planned on this show. Well, not nothing. Very little. See, they're even laughing. They're afraid no one's listening. They're afraid I'll get depressed if they don't laugh. Are you at least playing the laughter out onto the air, Phil? Thank God. At least they can hear someone laughing. As I've gotten older now, I want that laughter in the background. That's like a canned thing you're not supposed to do if you're really great. I haven't done it in 15 years, but I'm going to do it now. They actually like me. The guys who work for me like me. You know that helps? I got to tell you something. Stop for a minute. I got to tell you a story now. Like when I was a kid, everything was a kid. You learned Freud said you were everything you were was at five already. And that used to worry me when I was 17 because I didn't like myself at five. And I'd look back and say, really? I can't change? I can't reinvent myself? I can't become anything better than what I was at five? What do you mean? And Freud, that old, who knows? He didn't mean like exactly you'd be. But like basically you were basically everything at five. And he was right. Fundamentally, nothing's changed. I was as funny and smart at three as I am now. I was always like this. Just my vocabulary got better and my experiences have added to it. Being a father has helped, et cetera. But the fact is, he was right in that way. But so what I'm saying is, you know, there it is. There's nothing you can do about certain things. You are who you are at a certain point. You got to learn to live with it. So here we are. Should I do that interview or not with that guy? Because I'm afraid they're going to get like a cartoonist after they do this. They could get George Gross's illegitimate grandson, very gross, who will do a horrible caricature of me and I'll be finished. Las Vegas Mike, should I do that interview with the mainstream paper magazine or not?
No. Because, you know, his reason is too shallow, Mike. It's... That's not the reason he wants to interview you. He has an ulterior motive. It may not be a bad one, but the motive could be as simple as he merely wants a feather in his cap. You're someone that he can't he just can't conquer in terms of his interviews or whatever. Who was he from? Rolling Stone magazine or something?
No. I would never ever go near Rolling Stone. I never liked that pot publication. Never.
The feather in his cap.
No, I would never consider Rolling Stone. I've always considered a degenerate rag.
Yeah.
But Mike, here's the thing. What do I gain by this? Nothing. And what do I lose by this if he makes me into the worst guy on earth? Nothing. So why should I do it? The answer is because maybe I can help him. What do I care if he gains something by it? I could be Gandhi-like in this case. But, you know, Mrs. Savage said, she said, listen to me. She said, even if this guy does the right thing by you and does a decent story, don't you remember what happened before? He'll take it to his editor, who's probably a gay guy, who's going to turn you into something else, alter the entire article, or destroy it altogether. It happened to me at Newsweek. I told you the story. I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was Jake Tapper. He was called on today, by the way. He's already, whoa, he's so big. They called him Jake Tapper of ABC News. But... I don't know if it was Jake. It was someone like that from Newsweek came out to do a thing on me about 5 years ago. I said, okay. And he came out to portrait me as some bad guy. But we had drinks, had dinner. He liked me. He said, yeah, I never thought you'd be like this. I said, what do you expect me to be? Your stereotype. Here's who I am. He liked me. You know, there's a guy. So he writes the article. it never came out. So I emailed him months later. I said, what happened? He said, my editor killed it. They won't publish the story because it's too complimentary of you. This guy, to his credit, quit the magazine about a month later. And I think he moved on. At least he had integrity. He did quit. And it was a big writer for Newsweek, and the editor, SOB, who I think now works for MSNBC or NBC, More Nonsense by Chicks, which one of the two I don't know, killed it. But look, Newsweek is basically out of business. Most of these people are out of business. I got to tell you something, people listening to this show. I want to thank you again. I mean, I don't do this enough. It is about me, and you have to be an egomaniac to do talk radio well. Let's be clear about it. In order to get up here on this stage every day and talk and have the guts to do it and say what you believe and take the heat, take the laughs, take the pratfalls, you have to have an awesome ego. And I got to tell you something. God knows I was blessed with that. But there has to be more to it than just that, or it wouldn't go on very long. There's a lot of people with big egos who are schmucks. They have no substance, no brains, no education, nothing to offer whatsoever. They're not even good enough to be a nightclub comedian. Maybe they'll work for Obama. But, I want to thank you for being such a loyal, loyal audience for 15 years. I didn't do this last week. I didn't thank you enough. Maybe I said it in passing. I know you listen for you, not for me. And that's understandable. We live in such a horrible world that when a light appears somewhere out there that is so remarkably different and is so bright, and you understand immediately that I am telling you the truth and I am giving you the emphasis on what's going on in this country and how evil it all really is. But I do it so that you can still handle it where you don't crack up altogether, and I bring you back with humor. I understand why you're listening. I understand why you need this show, and I understand how incredibly important that is to you, and I want to thank you for doing it. It's totally symbiotic, and I again want to thank you from the absolute bottom of my being for listening to the Savage Nation. Momentarily, I'll be back right here.
Savage.
This is Jumping with Your Boy Mike in the Nation. Little Charlie Parker here to get you through the night on the Savage Nation. You know what my politics are. There's no point in beating you up with it. I'm an older American who knows what America really was and what it could be again if only we could rid ourselves of these social workers who are in the White House. Let me tell you something, Johnson. Charlie Parker could not emerge in today's America. Oh, I recognize that Obama is himself a half black man. And I recognize he wants to end poverty in his lifetime. And I recognize he wants to do good for all bad people on the earth. But let me tell you something, Johnson. Charlie Parker could never emerge in Obama's America. This is the Savage Nation. I got this today from the internet. Someone sent it to me. High school, 1959 versus 2009. Scenario one. Jack goes quail hunting before school and then pulls into the school parking lot with a shotgun in his truck's gun rack. 1959, vice principal comes over, looks at Jack's shotgun, goes to his car and gets his shotgun to show Jack. 2009, school goes into lockdown. FBI call. Jack hauled off to jail. Never sees his truck or gun again. Counselors called in for traumatized students and teachers. Scenario two, high school 1959 versus high school 2009. Johnny and Mark get into a fist fight after school. 1959, crowds gather. Mark wins. Johnny and Mark shake hands and end up buddies. 2009, police call and SWAT team arrives. They arrest both Johnny and Mark, and they are both charged with assault. Both expelled even though Johnny started it. Scenario three. Jeffrey will not sit still in class. He disrupts other students. 1959, Jeffrey sent to the principal's office and given a good paddling by the principal. He then returns to class, sits still, and does not disrupt class again. 2009, Jeffrey is given huge doses of Ritalin. He becomes a zombie. He is then tested for ADD. The school gets extra money from the state because Jeffrey has a disability. Scenario four, Billy breaks a window in his neighbor's car and his dad gives him a whipping with his belt. 1959, Billy is more careful next time, grows up normal, goes to college and becomes a successful man. 2009, Billy's dad is arrested for child abuse. Billy is removed to foster care and joins a gang. The state psychologist is told by Billy's sister that she remembers being abused herself, and their dad goes to prison. Billy's mom has an affair with the psychologist. That's the world I'm from.
Savage.
Jumping with my boy, see it in the city. Jumping with my boy, see it in the city. Mr. President of the DJ committee. We're gonna be up all night getting witty. We want you to spin the sounds by the witty. From down in the land that's real, real pretty. Make everything go real crazy over Jay-Z. Make everything go real crazy over Jay-Z. Play anything cool for me and my baby. We don't want to think we're listening to lazy. It's got to be press, bird cheering all the bassy. The dial is all set right close to 80. Let her roll.
Listen to this. Oh, my God. Come on. Listen to this saxophone. This is Symphony Sid, King Pleasure. This is not Symphony Sid, the DJ, the great jazz DJ. It's about him. What an honor that was. It's King Pleasure doing the thing. Doing the thing. So what I'm saying is, if I tell you these are my worldviews, it is because I come from another age, another time. This is the way I look at the world. Now you may say, okay, I can relate to it. Or you may say, I don't relate to it. I'm from another generation. I look at it differently. And I'm not asking for your yeses or your noes here. I'm just telling you where I'm coming from. And part of where I am coming from is explained by my taste in music, for example, even my taste in jazz. I never rarely play classical music, but trust me, I could do that. I do a lot of rock and roll Friday. Maybe I could do a jazz Thursday or whatever, but today's been a lot of jazz because we are doing it. And so I'm doing it like something somebody sent me from the internet called High School 1959 versus 2009. But remember, I'm from another time, another place. So you say, well, it's Neanderthal times. Well, let me tell you something, man. I'm glad to be a Neanderthal. Because I don't like the world that I've been drug into by these pinheaded, fraudulent, neo-Marxist phonies who really don't want to do good. They want to control everybody's life from cradle to grave. They want to equalize income around the world, take from those who earn and give it to those who don't, and I will fight it every step of the way. So play a little A-Train by Duke Ellington on the Savage Nation. Because I rode the A-Train in order to get to the Z-Train. I started on the A train. I rode the E train. I wore the ugly raincoat. I worked the horrible jobs. I didn't have a you-know-what to pee in. I'm on the Z train, man. You try to take it away from me. You didn't give it to me. No slaves gave it to me. My grandfather was a slave in the sweatshops of New York. So don't give me any more of that liberal double talk that your ancestors were a slave and I owe it to you. I don't owe you garbage. And I speak for most of America. So when I hear Obama getting up there today in the Queen's England and coming up with this rubbish that we got to take care of, that we shouldn't run away from the world's poor. We are the most generous nation on earth. Where's he coming up with, like, we're a bad nation all of a sudden? Again, he and his wife are good. Everybody before him was bad. Meanwhile, they gave away $1 trillion now to the developing nations again. And they won't disclose, by the way. See, I didn't want to do this. They say that the G20 leaders have agreed to give $1 trillion to struggling nations. Oh, really? Which nations are giving how much? That they didn't disclose. I can guarantee you this. Old George Soros, the puppet master who put this president in place, in my opinion, is not going to lose a penny on that $1 trillion. That I can guarantee you, okay? And you can put that into your pipe and smoke it along with your keef. Bakersfield, Nancy, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello there. You're on a roll today, aren't you?
I am, and I ate a roll for breakfast.
Are you having a scotch?
No, I did not have one tonight.
You know what? I'm telling you the truth. You're so funny that you don't realize how funny you are. That's why you're funny.
Yeah, that's now I'm going to be like the character in who was that character, Beowulf? I'm funny? How am I funny? What do you mean I'm funny? He shoots the guy in the foot? Joe Pesci, that was the greatest response to you're funny. He says, what do you mean I'm funny? I don't like that. How am I funny? No, I mean that was a funny joke. Who are you to tell me I'm funny? Remember that? The guys who are funny have that thing in them, by the way. I've always been funny. But the thing is that we don't like when you say we're funny. Then we don't like you anymore. Did I touch on the queen being touched by Michelle? I did. I touched on it. You heard already my position on that one. Then I'm going to go back to high school 5909. That's funny. Before I know it, the next hour is over, and I have a beer and another a chowder and an internet, the crossroads, water, ocean. So Symphony Sid, just before I finished on this, if you never heard of him, because he's been dead since 84, Symphony Sid was a Jewish guy from the Lower East Side, and he was just basically a jazz and Latin music disc jockey that everyone understood was the greatest disc jockey of all time, probably, and probably even greater than the Balloon Man, who no one ever heard of since he went to the scam artists on the satellite broadcasting network. But I read the Symphony Sid that went to New York City in 1956. Late in life, he lived in Florida, where he enjoyed the pursuit of fishing. He died September 14th, 1984. I don't know how he could enjoy fishing. How could you go from being like a jazz, Latin jazz guy, jazz and Latin music, you know, rhythm and blues, one of the best-known disc jockeys in the world. He introduced rock and roll to rock people to rock and roll who never heard of rock and roll. And, you know, he knew everybody in the jazz business, and they loved him. He used to broadcast from Birdland over WJZ. Imagine that. He was arrested and given a suspended sentence for having marijuana in his apartment. All right, in those days, they'd have marijuana. If you're in jazz, you'd have dope with the musicians. They all had to do that. I don't understand that, but okay, we're going to do that. And Charlie Parker, you know, your name, you mentioned those names. He's involved with that Birdland. You say Birdland, Bop City, Royal Roost. You say 52nd Street Jazz Clubs. All gone with the wind except for the people who remember jazz. You understand who Symphony Sid was. No one knows who he is today. But what I'm saying, the guy was amazing. His voice was astonishing on the air. Now, why am I telling you this? I don't know what his politics were. If he was a pot-smoking Jewish guy for Lower East Side, guaranteed communist, unionist. That I can guarantee. I don't care what his politics were. It doesn't matter to me. All I know is that the guy had a mellifluous voice. And when I was coming home after a hard day in the anatomy lab, studying the memorizing the entrails of a pig in Latin in high school or in early college, you know, with smelling the formaldehyde in the refrigerator mixed in with my mother's gefilte fish. Did I ever tell you that story when I put the pig in the refrigerator? You never heard that story when my aunt found the pig in the refrigerator. You got to hear that story one of these days. I don't have the time for it. After a hard day of formaldehyde and pig's entrails in Latin memory, whatever, or a cat skeleton in a box where I'm memorizing the names of the cat skeleton in anatomy. This is an undergraduate school, mind you. This is what you would imagine in my day. If you went to college and you took biology as a major, you had to like remember all the parts of a disarticulated cat skeleton or you'd get a D. And they throw you, an F in anatomy. And then you have to take a pig home and learn all of its parts in Latin. You know what they have to do today to get an A and go on to Yale or Harvard? I can just imagine. You have to praise the Obamaites for what they've done for the poor of the world, I would suppose, and teach youngsters how to put a condom on a plantain, let alone a cucumber. Because in my, you know, just a few years ago, it was a plantain and a cucumber passed for muster. Today, no more with the third world invasion. They have to teach them how to put a plantain on a... They have to do a condom on a plantain, never mind. Let her roll. Let her roll. So there we were. But I'm going back to Symphony Sid now. I don't want to get off track here. Symphony Sid's on. Now, day, nights, now it's nighttime. Anatomy, pig, formaldehyde, your head's bursting, Migraineville. How am I going to remember all this garbage? It's Friday night. Please let me out of here because tomorrow I got to work with Dad. Which another prize coming tomorrow after 5 days of the school. What a lovely idea that is, going with him over the Kosciuszko Bridge into DeSoto with no music and going into the basement to clean things. I love that. Well, the other boys are learning how to play tennis and ski. I like that, you know. Even though they were in the new world, I still was in the old world. Not only was I in the old world, but I was in Charles Dickens' old world, let alone the old world. I wasn't even the old world of my father's father. I was in the old world of Charles Dickens. So we go to the Palladium. And we listened mainly to Latin music. At that time, there was the most phenomenal change, and it got you out of yourself. If you could listen to some of the Cuban musicians at that time, now there were some fabulous jumping Puerto Rican musicians. I came to love Panamanian music, by the way, which I found to be great at the time. But the best was the music that was coming out of Cuba. There was no question about it. We're talking 50s. We're talking late 50s, early 60s. Cuban music, as it was played in New York City, one of the great times in the history of the world for music. People love that music before it got polluted by some guy. I mean, he tried to reintroduce it with that thing, but he put a guitar into it, like a twangy Hawaiian guitar. I never understood that. Remember he did the Hawaiian thing, he went to Cuba, and he did the Cuban All-Stars. That was amazing, but then he had to ruin it, the filmmaker, with his guitar. What was that all about? The twangy Don Ho thing he threw in there, wrecked everything. But we heard it in the Purista, the Puro, El Puro, you know. You got any Cuban music, so they know what I'm talking about, which I do a little bit of. No, don't like it. It's too jumpy, too dancey. Give me something like with Duende, which I described the other day. Even though we're talking to crackers in Montana. No, I don't like female vocalists. I don't like them generally. I like macho singers, I got to tell you right now. That's it. I want to hear the vibration of the man's, you know. Is this Sonora Matancera? Who is this? I don't know right now. No. The song is called Guajira. Okay, now, if you saw Godfather 2, remember when they take him to that club with the Cuban Superman with the large, and the senator gets excited, and he says, I want a redhead, and he says, con gusto, you'll have that, blah, blah, blah. And then the senator turns to Michael Corleone, the Weak brother, whatever his name was, Fredo, and he says, how did you find this place, Fredo? They're all excited looking at the Cuban Superman turning around with the cape. And he says, oh, old man, whatever, Johnny took me here. Old man, whatever, the Jewish guy, Meyer Lansky, wouldn't come here, but old Johnny, he knows his way around these places. Camera moves on Al Pacino's character, Michael Corleone. His face turns white. He realizes that his brother stabbed him in the back. Okay? That's what we're talking about. They understood the music. So now picture that band on the stage, like 32 pieces, feathers on the girls. They produce music like that today under communism? You must be joking. The girls are selling themselves for Coca-Cola in Castro's Cuba now. Tell me they had it worse under Batista. Cuba was better under Batista, you schmuck. Of course it was corrupt. Just like America was great when it was corrupt. You watch out for the do-gooder. All I can warn you is the purest of do-gooder will put you on a road to hell faster than any gangster ever will. That's all I can promise you. Because Michael knows the world. See, the smart gangster understands that in order to survive, he's got to leave something for the society to have. He can't take it all. It's a new age now. Now they want the whole world, they want to suck it through their horn, and wind up with nothing left. They don't even understand the whole balance. So you go back to the age of Batista. I'm not glorifying it. There was poverty there, right? Oh, there's no poverty in Cuba now. Oh, they all got health care. Health care, that's all they sold. When the Castro brothers came to town, if they stole everything from the middle class, everyone had health care. But when they need health care, they get a Jewish doctor from Miami flown in disguise, in mufti. They don't go to a Cuban doctor from the University of Havana who has a dirty bib on with a stethoscope that they could stab to death with the pieces falling off. You know, Castro himself, like 2 years ago, remember when he was near death? Looked horrible. Finally, after all the cigars, I said, he's mortal after all. Why are these SOBs? They live forever. The guy went on and on, giving 10-hour speeches every night. All the women of Cuba, they had to submit to him. I don't know how the guy did it. 20 cigars a night, women, coffee, rum. You don't understand because the devil lives forever, okay? So he gets sick as a dog. He looks like he's on death's door. He went to a Cuban doctor? No, he got a doctor from Spain. Again, probably a Marano. His grandfather was probably, again, a Jewish from fled, you know, during the Middle Ages. He was a Marano and became a Catholic. All right, who else is he going to go to? He's going to go to one of the doctors from his facultative medical school, the University of Havana? You would go there? What, are you kidding me? That's why it was a joke inside The Godfather when the Meyer Lansky character's dying and they bring in the doctor who tells him in Spanish what's wrong. He says, I don't trust anyone who can't speak English. Fly my doctor in from Miami. I mean, come on, who wrote that stuff? Mario Puzo. Unbelievable. I'll be right back. Savage. back to high school 1959 versus high school 2009. Scenario 5. Mark gets a headache and takes some aspirin to school. In 1959, Mark shares his aspirin with the principal out on the smoking dock. In 2009, the police are called and Mark is expelled from school for drug violations. His car is then searched for drugs and weapons. Scenario 6. Pedro fails high school English. In 1959, Pedro goes to summer school, passes English, and goes to college. In 2009, Pedro's course is taken up by state. Newspaper articles appear nationally explaining that teaching English as a requirement for graduation is racist. The ACLU files class action lawsuit against the state school system and Pedro's English teacher. English is then banned from core curriculum. Pedro is given his diploma anyway, but ends up mowing lawns for a living because he cannot speak English. Scenario 7. Johnny takes apart leftover firecrackers from the 4th of July, puts them in a model airplane paint bottle, and blows up a red ant bed. In 1959, ants die. In 2009, ATF, Homeland Security, and the FBI are all called. Johnny is charged with domestic terrorism. The FBI investigates his parents, and all siblings are removed from their home, and all computers are confiscated. Johnny's dad is placed on a terror watch list and is never allowed to lie again. Scenario 8. Comparing 59 to 2009 in a high school. Johnny falls while running during recess and scrapes his knee. He is found crying by his teacher, Mary. Mary hugs him to comfort him. 1959, in a short time, Johnny feels better and goes on playing. 2009, Mary, the teacher, is accused of being a sexual predator and loses her job. She faces 3 years in state prison. Johnny undergoes 5 years of therapy. Now you understand where I'm coming from, right? I mean, my world was shaped then, not now, and I'm proud of it. And I really don't care what you think of me. And there's more of me than there are of you. Make no mistake about it. Yeah, you think there are more of you because you schmucks have idiots like you in the newspaper business and on television. And you have all the men without private parts telling you that you want to hear the kind of garbage you want to hear. But this is what most Americans think, whether they were born 15 years ago or 60 years ago, by the way. They don't think like you do, you left-wing schmucks. And let me tell you something again. I'm going to say it until you hear me. If the election were held again today, even schmuck McCain would win by 15 points. There is such voters' remorse in this country from this fraud artist that you can't believe it. Play some heavy metal right now. If you observe life as I do, and I can go from jazz to Latin music to this, why is that? Because I observe and I feel. If I see a guy, a white guy, 6'5", who's built like a tank, and he's driving a delivery truck, and he's got tattoos, and he wants to kill people, and he's listening to this in his truck, you think he's not a human being? Why, just because Woody Allen thinks he's funny? You think he's funny? You think he's not seething? You think he doesn't know what's going on in this country? You think because he doesn't have a degree from Yale, he's a dummy? Okay, I see it all. I'm a kaleidoscopic mind. I'm Michael Savage. Cool. Now let's go back to Jackie's voice. I want to hear Jackie to calm everyone down at the end of the thing. Because this is Jackie Kennedy, because we're doing comparison and contrast today in the classroom.
And the China is the Eisenhower gold China.
China, I love
you
that.
You see, so many of the beautiful old services the president
China
had
is China.
Were destroyed and broken. So now the Truman and the Eisenhower China is all
she
the business
JFK.
Left up to you.
She had Frank Sinatra.
And there is the
she
beautiful
had Aristotle
Monroe
Onassis already. Maybe she took even
and
him.
His flower or fruit
the money, you know what I mean?
Candelabra, all
candelabra, the
from
China,
France,
whatever.
1817.
I read that they had a prenup. God rest his soul. I don't mean to disgrace, but they had a prenup where it was only a certain number of days a month that he was allowed to, like, be a man with her. What? Is that organized? At that level of society? It's like, okay, Wednesdays on the 15th of the month, you're allowed to come in my bedroom for 12 and a half minutes while we're playing Brahms. And then you have to leave, you ugly beast. And leave a lot of money in the kid's account, okay?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Here's what I've been talking about today in the Savage Nation. Obama the globalist. Obama apparently has solved all of America's problems. He has put pot in every chicken and chicken in every pot. And now he's on to the world to see if he can put pot in every chicken around the world and provide a chicken for every pot head around the world. Michelle and Jackie, part two. The media continuing to harp on Michelle Obama as the new Jackie Kennedy. I'm not so sure. Michelle broke protocol by hugging the Queen of England. Were you shocked by this? Or, well, hey, it could be the first time the Queen's been touched in 60 years. Good for you, Michelle. Go, girl. God. That's my take on it, actually. Great. She touched her. She's liable to run off with a guy from Brixton after this. Yeah, man, had I only known. Woo, that's what a human touch feels like, huh? Obama. The would-be president of the world. We knew that Obama was a globalist. We knew that Obama was a neo-Marxist. But today at the G20 summit in London, England, we found out that in addition to these things, Obama wants to be president of the world. He was asked by a Chinese reporter how he would make sure that local politics would not interfere with good economics. Listen to this clip.
How can you make sure that you will do whatever you can so that bad local politics will not Trump or negatively affect good international economics? Thank you, Mr. President.
Now, when the Chinese reporter says local politics, what he means is the national interests, the national security interests, the national economic interests of you, the citizen of the United States of America. That's what this tool of the Chinese government was trying to reduce our national policy to. And Obama played right along with it. He said while he's president of the United States, it's his responsibility to lead America into a global new world order. You must listen to this comment in full.
Look, I'm the president of the United States. I'm not the president of China. I'm not the president of Japan. I'm not the president of the other participants here. And so I have a direct responsibility to my constituents to make their lives better. That's why they put me in there. In an era of integration and interdependence, it is also my responsibility to lead America into recognizing that its interests, its fate is tied up with the larger world.
What he's saying is that the poor of the world are more important than the poor of the United States. The education of the world's children is more important than the education of our children. And the medication of the world's poor, all billions of them, is as important as the medication for your grandmother. And he went on to call protectionism a short-term interest. You won't believe this. You got to listen.
There are going to be times where short-term interests are going to differ. There's no doubt about it. And protectionism is the classic example. You can make arguments that if you can get away with protecting your markets, as long as the other folks don't protect theirs, then in the short term, you may benefit. And, you know, it then becomes important not only for me to try to give people a sense of why over the long term that's counterproductive.
So in other words, our American interests are only short-term interests. The real interests we should be looking out for are those of the world. The interests of Europe, the interests of Africa, the interests of China. These are much more important than our petty parochial needs in the U.S. And so while Obama claims to be president of the United States, that's clearly not the position he wants to hold on to. He wants to move on to be the president of the world. So I guess when the Martians come and they say, take me to your leader, or shall I say, take me to your reader, it will be Obama that they take them to. Ah, but moving on. The budget is being talked about in Congress. Hidden within this monstrous beast are several hidden taxes and other things that really need to be brought into the light. Joining us today from the Heritage Foundation is Ben Lieberman to look at some of the problems with this bill.
Thanks, Michael. Well, the Obama budget is out and is being debated in Congress. And there's a lot for the American people to be worried about in it, not just as taxpayers, but also as energy users. In fact, there are several things in the budget specifically designed to drive up the cost of energy. Now, far and away, the biggest and scariest thing in the budget is the backdoor attempt to impose costly global warming measures. These so-called cap-and-trade provisions would place limits on the amount of coal, oil, and natural gas we could use. And keep in mind, these fossil fuels currently provide 85% of America's energy. These measures are really just an energy tax in disguise. And in fact, the budget assumes they will generate $650 billion in additional revenues. And keep in mind, these are revenues that come from higher energy costs, especially electricity and gasoline. And one administration official said the cost of this grandiose global warming agenda, an agenda that's already proven to be a failure in Europe, the cost could be 2 to 3 times higher than that, so upwards of $1.9 trillion. So we're talking about household costs into the thousands of dollars per year, as well as potentially millions of lost jobs in the manufacturing sector, all to address the overstated threat of global warming and to address it in a way that wouldn't make much difference even if it was a crisis. It's little wonder the administration and some in Congress are trying to slip this unpopular environmental measure into a budget bill, because if they did it in standalone legislation, it probably wouldn't do much better than the global warming bill that failed badly in the Senate last summer. Unfortunately, costly global warming measures are not the only energy problems with this bill. There's also tens of billions in taxpayer dollars going to various alternative energy sources, like wind power and cellulosic ethanol. Well, when it comes to alternatives, we have to be realistic. And the reality is that these alternatives need so many taxpayer handouts for good reason. And that's because they're too expensive to compete otherwise. So the government is spending our tax dollars on energy sources that are going to cost us more, a double whammy for the American people. Now, there's one thing that clearly we should be doing on energy, and that's making better use of the domestic energy resources we have in this country, both onshore and offshore, especially oil and natural gas. Instead, the budget contains a number of tax increases aimed specifically at energy companies that will discourage them from engaging in additional energy production. Now, sure, the oil companies should pay their fair share of taxes, but the Obama administration budget goes too far, treating those companies like an ATM machine and doing so in ways that discourage domestic energy production. It's the kind of short-sighted approach that would hasten a return to $4 a gallon gasoline that we saw last summer. Indeed, the real solution to our energy challenges is the exact opposite of what the administration's budget and other measures are doing. Rather than discouraging affordable energy and domestic energy production, we should be encouraging it. Measures like the recently proposed No-Cost Stimulus Act of 2009 would seek to open up new offshore and onshore areas to oil and natural gas production and streamline costly environmental regulations in creating jobs and lowering the price of energy in the years ahead. The name of the game is more affordable and more plentiful energy supplies, including domestic ones, and that's the direction I wish the Obama administration would be moving towards instead of away from.
Thanks, Ben. I have to agree. It seems that we're going in the wrong direction. Michelle versus Jackie, round two. Yesterday I talked about the differences between Jackie O and Michelle O, and I should note that when you responded to that topic yesterday, I don't think I got a single call saying Michelle O was better as the first lady than Jackie O. But seeing that this is Michelle O's first overseas trip, let's get into the specifics of what's happened so far. This much we know. She allowed her husband to present the Queen of England with the tacky gift of an iPod, something which the Queen already had, and which was a completely inappropriate gift for one head of state to give to another. A more attentive first lady would have never have allowed this to have happened. Traditionally, it's been the job of first ladies to look after just such matters as style, protocol, and deportment. Apparently, Michelle was too busy doing other things. Furthermore, Michelle broke protocol when she gave the Queen a hug in their meeting yesterday. British protocol says you're not supposed to touch the Queen. Apparently, no booby or no bobby bothered to tell Michelle this, or she couldn't be bothered to find out. But actually, I think it was great that the Queen got touched. Maybe the first time she's been touched in 70, 75 years. Who knows, she might run off with a Jamaican from Brixton after this. So what happened to Jackie Kennedy when she went to England during her husband's presidency? Let's see. Jackie refused to talk about her meeting with the Queen, except to say that she was charming and gracious. Listen to Jackie's clip.
Did you enjoy a really good lunch, an English lunch?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Tell me, had the Queen seen...
So kind to have me there.
Oh, no.
I don't think I should say anything about it, except that how grateful I am and how charming she was.
On Jackie's visit to France, she was a hit because of her French background and fluency in French. And Khrushchev wanted to shake her hand before he shook JFK's. So you can compare the two of them all you want. But when it comes to first ladies, it seems we've come a long way, baby. I'll be right back. Savage. Continuing correspondence with a big shot magazine writer who wants to fly to San Francisco to interview me. And we talked about it about a week ago, and I said, should I or shouldn't I submit myself to the interview? Well, I got to read you what came in over the last few days, those of you who called in on this. And I'll begin with the last couple of responses. I said to him at one point, I said, remember now, it's a big, big magazine. This is something everybody wants to have done, which is a, you know, kind of a biography profile. And you all hope it's complimentary, but often it isn't, particularly if you're a conservative. They try to turn you into something that you're not. So I finally sent him a note and I said, what is your orientation here? What is it you're after? Every other journalist, London Times, et cetera, told me they'd be fair. They never mentioned my 20 books. My ethnobotanical research, my grants to Marines and cops. All they wrote about was their own biases. How can I help you? And then he wrote this back and he said, I understand completely. I've been doing this long enough to know you can't promise anyone that they'll like what you write about them. But I can say that I have no interest in writing a story that reads like an expose. That's been done anyway. Reporters sometimes act as if your expertise in herbal medicine and your upbringing in the Bronx with deep, dark secrets, even though you regularly talk about both on the air. So, I mean, the guy has a, you know, at least he listens to the show. And he goes on. So I said, well, let's email for a bit. And I said, I've been lied to and set up before, most notably every magazine and newspaper writer who I've ever been befriended. Why must everyone in journalism be so obvious? Why must all of you in the extreme media paint everyone you disagree with as demonic? Why is the homosexual agenda so important to the midstream media? The San Francisco Chronicle, once a decent average newspaper, is now defunct, largely because of the above attitudes I sent to him. So then he sends me another one. I don't even know where it is. It's a good one. Oh, here it is. He says, this came today. He says, well, I can certainly understand why you mistrust the mainstream or midstream media, including this magazine. Now, listen carefully. He says, all I can say is that I've got no interest in writing why Savage is evil or whatever. Sounds boring and stupid. I hate stories like that. The story I want to write isn't primarily about politics. Listen to this carefully. In fact, if all you talked about was politics, I probably wouldn't even be interested in writing about you, Savage. In my view, a big part of what makes Savage unique is the wide range of topics you talk about and write about, especially in psychological nudity. In 10 minutes, the topic might shift from the G20 summit to Cuban food to frog legs to your dog, Teddy. The person who can do all that and do it every day is a person worth reading about. The other day you said you had a kaleidoscopic mind, which seems like a pretty good description. That's a story I haven't read before, and that's the story I want to tell. That's why I was hoping to talk to you in person. I can well understand if you'd rather not. It's not like you need the press coverage, but hey, I figure I might as well ask again, right? Now, I got to tell you, so when I read this today, because he heard the show, I said, you know what? Here's what I'm going to write him. Now listen carefully. He says to me, I sent him this. I said, you can talk to me in person. Okay. I'm interested in literature and writers. I will be back in San Francisco about mid-April. Will this work? The only thing I cannot do is invite you into one of my radio studios. It throws me off when I perform for a visitor. Better to stay grumpy and alone and see what my friends inside my mind want to say. All right, let's move on. Here's what's on my website, michaelsavage.com, from Fox News. Israeli youth killed in West Bank. Axe attack. An axe-wielding Palestinian militant. Well, I wouldn't call him a militant. Would you call someone with an axe who cuts a kid's head off a militant? How about calling him a subhuman scum-sucking vermin from the Middle East? Went on a rampage in a West Bank settlement, killing an Israeli 13-year-old boy and wounding a 7-year-old boy. Of course, they say Israeli youth killed. You know, to the media, the only victims can be Palestinians. You understand that. From the LA Times on MichaelSavage.com, millions missing in funds controlled by a federal judge. And who was the federal judge? Well, you have to read the whole article to find out it has something to do with the Philippine community. You would have thought it would have been Timothy McVeigh or Richard Nixon, but no, $5 million, maybe $10 million disappeared, entrusted to a judge. And the claimants, mainly Filipinos, want to know what happened to their money, who was entrusted to the hands of one of their brethren. Read the article. You won't find it in your local paper, I can guarantee you. On the right side of MichaelSavage.com, we covered the monologue from yesterday, Michelle Obama versus Jackie Kennedy. Huh. You know, that story is a pretty good one. Underneath it is a sad, crazy, insane story. Sailor chokes to death on bait fish with children looking on. What? A charter boat crew member choked to death after swallowing a bait fish as a joke in front of elementary school children during a field trip in the port of Long Beach. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. In Modesto, an officer was attacked by gangbangers. They don't describe who they were, nor their race. Just they described them as a hostile crowd that threw bottles at the policeman and his police dog. And they say it's a gang-ridden neighborhood, but they don't let you know whether it was a gang of religious Christians, religious Jews, Hispanics with tattoos, or blacks with dreadlocks. Of course, the G20 protesters ho-hum another day, another protest. This was a big one. Steny Hoyer, a member of the Democrat Party, by the way, says, I don't know where Obama got the legal authority for the auto plan. Hello? And finally today on MichaelSavage.com, from the London Times, North Korea threatens to shoot down U.S. spy planes ahead of the missile launch. Oh, yeah, right. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
You listen to the Savage Nation, not just to hear my opinions, but to get the news stories no other show seems to talk about. Joining us now is Jeffrey Kuhner with the Washington Times with a report on Iran that you won't hear anywhere else either.
Michael, I have two blockbuster scoops exclusive for the Savage Nation. Iran is on the march. The Washington Times just last week broke a major story that Hezbollah, a terrorist group backed and funded and supported by Iran, whose sole mission is to destroy the state of Israel and to launch fierce, devastating terrorist attacks upon the United States. Hezbollah is now forming an alliance with the Mexican drug cartels to use their transit routes to penetrate our border and to come into the United States. As we reported in last week's editions, Michael, Hezbollah has now sent in agents that are smuggling drugs to destroy and poison our youth. They are coming into this country, smuggling weapons, laundering money, and they are sending it back to fund their terrorist activities. And even more ominously, Michael, what we have found out through talking to law enforcement officials, intelligence officials, people very deep within the CIA and the Homeland Security Department, is that now there are sleeper cells all across the United States who are waiting to launch either a dirty bomb attack or terrorist attacks upon American buildings, American civilians, and American targets. And Michael, this is part of Iran's larger strategy to not only consolidate their power in the region, but to launch a war against the West and the United States. The other major scoop that I have, Michael, for exclusively for the Savage Nation, is that as the mainstream media has been focused on the G20 summit, or have they been focused on Michelle Obama's wardrobe or her gardening, What they have overlooked is one of the most sensational stories of the year. Iran's Deputy Defense Minister, Ali Reza Asghari, a key figure in the Iranian regime, has defected. And as he has defected, he has now told Western and American intelligence officials literally the inside scoop on Iran's nuclear program. He has revealed that for years, Iran has been building a nuclear weapons program, a bomb. Not only that, Michael, Iran has now formed an unholy axis with North Korea and especially with Syria. In fact, what Asghari confirmed is that in September 2007, Michael, you and your listeners will probably remember that Israel launched a devastating airstrike upon Syrian soil, destroying a reactor, a nuclear reactor. Asghari has now confirmed unequivocally that that reactor was built by the North Koreans. It was funded, sponsored, and supported by Iran, and that Iran was exporting its nuclear weapons program to Syria so it could be built there as well and not just in Iran. In other words, Michael, we now have a senior Iranian government official in the highest echelons of power confirming that President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Iran's Persian Nazi dictator, is now hell-bent not only on destroying Israel, but on destroying America, that he is now months, if not a year, away from acquiring a nuclear bomb. And Michael, let me be very clear about this. Iran is the seminal issue of our time. Ahmadinejad is the Hitler of our age. And what we are now witnessing across the Western world is almost literally a replay of the 1930s. We are mired in a very severe economic recession and a financial crisis. Our government is adrift. We are experimenting with radical socialism. We have a world, a war-weary public that no longer wants to fight our enemies abroad. We have lost the stomach for the war in Iraq. We are adrift in Afghanistan. Our major enemies, Russia and China, are gathering strength and gathering steam. And as this goes on, the greatest threat to Western civilization and to the Jews, a Nazi Iran, is getting stronger and closer to the bomb day by day. Just as the 1930s, when Adolf Hitler was slowly amassing his armies, when he was vowing openly to the German people and to all of Europe that his goal was to destroy the Jews and eventually launch a devastating war against the West. Our craven politicians then, led by FDR and Britain's Neville Chamberlain, what did they champion? Just what Obama is championing today, diplomacy and appeasement. They want to talk with a fascist, brutal, evil dictator. And this is what Obama is doing right now. We are literally replaying the fatal, calamitous mistakes of the 1930s. Obama has now sanctioned one-on-one, face-to-face negotiations. And Michael, here is the key point that I want to stress to you and to all of your listeners. If there is one point I want to say, it is this. We are sleepwalking towards disaster and a major war in the Middle East. Because as Asghari has said, the senior Iranian official, Ahmadinejad is not interested in negotiations. What he wants is a bomb. And as Ahmadinejad has said repeatedly, and as the Iranian mullahs have repeated now for the last 20 years, in every sermon they deliver, in every textbook in their classroom, in every propaganda broadcast on television, Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth. Just as Hitler vowed he would kill every last Jew and to completely destroy and defeat the Western world. And as this goes on, as week by week, month by month, Ahmadinejad and Iran gets closer to the bomb, we dither. We are morally paralyzed. We have no answer for him. We have lost our will. We have lost our confidence. We now have a weak leader. We have a socialist who is willing to sell out our most fundamental interests and our most fundamental values. And Michael, I believe that we are now reaching the tipping point, the point of no return. And I have been speaking to Israeli intelligence officials. And Michael, I have to tell you this. In all of my life, in all of my years of being in Washington, of all of the years I've been talking to Israeli military and intelligence officials, I have never seen the Jews this afraid. And what Benjamin Netanyahu, the new Israeli prime minister, has said is that he will not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And if that means sending in the Israeli Air Force and destroying all of Iran's nuclear facilities, then he will do that. But if he does do that, this will unleash a regional war across the Middle East. Iran will attack Israel, and most importantly, Michael, Ahmadinejad has vowed that these Hezbollah sleeper cells that have now penetrated our porous southern border will unleash wave after wave after wave of terrorist attacks upon American cities. They will destroy our bridges. They will destroy our financial centers. They will come after our government buildings. They will come after our shopping centers. There will be American blood in the streets. And this is why, Michael, I have been urging this for a long time, and I'm making one last final appeal to policymakers in Washington. Please stop what you are doing. You are leading us down to the road of death, destruction, and ruin. We have one major weapon. It is the mega weapon, and that is the Iranian people. Michael, I have been talking to Iranian dissidents. The Iranian people are sick of the mullahs. They're sick of their fundamentalism. They're sick of their anti-Semitism. They're sick of their anti-Americanism. They want to overthrow this regime. And more importantly, Michael, these mullahs can boast about a bomb, and they can boast about supporting terrorists, and they can boast about suicide bombings and killing innocent women and children, but they have driven their economy into the ground. And Michael, here is the mother of all points. Iran may export all of its oil, and it may be a big oil exporter, but its refining capacity is literally that of a bankrupt third world nation. 40% of its gasoline relies on imports. So what I have been arguing again and again, we do not even need to go to war against Iran. If we just put comprehensive crippling sanctions, in particular against all of those international oil companies, the handful of them, there's less than a dozen of them, who have been selling Iran their gas so that they can keep their economy going. If we tell them, you can no longer do business with Iran, we will literally choke the economy of Iran overnight. And this will drive the Iranian people into the streets. Student groups are opposed to the regime. Women's groups are opposed to the regime. Labor groups are opposed to the regime. Democrats are opposed to the regime. Ethnic minorities are opposed to the regime. Everybody is opposed to this regime. If we impose crippling sanctions, this will push the public over the edge, and they will do what should have been done years ago, internal regime change. If we change the regime, we can avert a war. Just as if we had changed the regime within Nazi Germany, had we funded the opposition against Hitler, not during World War II, but in 1933 and 1934 and 1935, we could have prevented the Holocaust. We could have prevented World War II. We could have prevented Auschwitz. We could have prevented 50 million dead. We can now prevent a potential nuclear Holocaust in the Middle East if our policymakers will just show some strength, some vision, and some courage.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm not entirely sure that our administration has the strength or courage to stand up and do the right thing. This is Dr. Dissident Michael Savage back in a moment.
Savage.
A while back, we mentioned about Homeland Security labeling people who support third-party candidates as possible militia members who should be put on a watch list. This is astounding. Joining us today with his opinion on this is Wayne Allen Root with RootForAmerica.com.
Thank you, Michael Savage. Hey, did anyone notice a story last week out of Missouri? A Homeland Security offshoot called a Fusion Center. What the heck is that? It's a think tank that provides intelligence information to law enforcement to aid in the fight versus terrorism, warned Missouri law enforcement that anyone with a Libertarian or a third-party bumper sticker on their car, anyone who supports candidates like Bob Barr or myself, Wayne Root, or Ron Paul, that famous Republican Libertarian, or even the Constitution Party candidate, or even an anti-abortion activist, might very well stand a high probability of being a militia member, a drug smuggler, or a terrorist. Yes, you heard right. According to Homeland Security, political dissent is now evidence of criminal activity in America. What? Ladies and gentlemen, I am a proud libertarian conservative. I'm a patriot. I love my country. I love and respect the military and law enforcement. I love the Constitution. I'm fighting every day to save my country. I'm a patriot. But Republicans, Democrats, and government bureaucrats want to classify me and people like me as militia members, as criminals, as terrorists? Is this the Soviet gulag or the United States of America? Is political dissent now on par with drug smuggling and kidnapping, according to the feds? Is anyone in defiance of the corrupt two-party system now a target of law enforcement? What's the crime? Driving while conservative? Driving while libertarian? In possession of non-controlled government thoughts? But the real criminal class, see, that's what they're trying to hide you from. The real criminal class is government. That's the point here. Barack Obama and his corrupt government cronies are simply holding WMD, weapons of mass distraction. They want to distract you from what's really going on. They're hijacking democracy. They're stifling dissent. They're destroying capitalism. They're scapegoating Wall Street. They're socializing America. They're redistributing the wealth from the productive class, taxpayers, job creators, small business owners, self-employed, the private sector, to people who do nothing, produce little or nothing, and expect, or should I say, demand government handouts. And he's combining that with millions of new government employees, local, state, federal employees, all members of government employee unions who live off of taxpayer money, who take no risks with their own money ever in their entire lives, who expect a job for life, a safe weekly paycheck, raises based on seniority but never based on performance, who are allowed to retire after 20 years at age 45, and who expect to collect a pension for life longer than they ever worked for government, and health care for life. This is Obama's crowd. These are the people who can't even get a job in the private sector.
How did they get away with this?
Weapons of mass distraction. Jokes on Jay Leno so he looks hip. Town hall meetings so he looks like a man of the people. He picks March Madness brackets. He and the Democratic Congress fight for a college football national championship game. All important issues, don't you think? He points fingers at rich people, executives, bankers. He says burn them at the stake. He hopes he can distract you. And he calls libertarians or conservatives, gun right activists, anti-abortion activists. He calls them criminals or terrorists or kooks. It's all to distract you from the truth that Obama's policies resemble a banana republic more than a capitalist nation. Think about it. Runaway inflation is on the way as the Fed runs the printing presses all day long, working overtime to print money to pay for $9.7 trillion in bailouts, multi-billion dollar and trillion dollar economic stimulus plans that are nothing more than pork, government jobs for unproductive people incapable of getting private sector jobs, devaluation of the dollar so we can pay our bills with inflation, high taxes to stave off economic disaster. Obama has tripled our national debt. His deficit is four times higher than the highest deficit under George W. Bush. His budget is larger than all the budgets in the history of America combined from George Washington to George W. Bush. His cap and trade taxes will quadruple your utility bills and your gas bills, and his car check legislation will bankrupt American business and turn even small business employees into union employees. Unconstitutional power grabs by Tim Geithner, a guy who doesn't pay his own taxes. A takeover of American business by the federal government. These are the cold, hard facts he doesn't want you to notice.
You say even other countries are noticing this movement towards fascism under Obama?
China wants a new reserve currency. Why? Because they know. They understand what Obama's up to, and they hold trillions in dollars. And China knows the dollar is dead. It's headed for zero. Inflation is rampant. China knows what's happening, and they see the writing on the wall. That was the tip-off. France is scolding us about our massive, unsustainable spending. France is scolding us. And the head of the EU is calling Obama's economic rescue plan a pathway to hell. Europeans are laughing at us. Barney Frank is watching over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Chris Dodd had oversight over banking and insurance while his wife worked for AIG. Rahm Emanuel, oh my gosh, he's running the White House. He used to be on the board of Fannie Mae, and he made over $325,000. Tim Geithner's in charge of business and tax policy. Well, he cheats on his own taxes, and he had oversight over Wall Street for years while he was head of the New York Fed and never noticed anything was wrong. It's all a smokescreen. Well, the criminals run the government. The politicians with oversight over banking, insurance, real estate, they were all collecting huge contributions from the very people they had oversight over. Wow, they were getting jobs for their spouses. Now they're smartly pointing fingers at business executives and trying to burn them at the stake, hoping you won't notice they were the ones that had the oversight. Now they're threatening to leak the names to the media of AIG executives so that those executives receive threats and rocks through their windows.
Unbelievable.
Obama is our Hugo Chavez. Think about it. Hugo Chavez demonizes the rich, distracts the masses with government handouts disguised as tax cuts. He pits the 95% versus the 5% of the high-income earners, the business class. He speaks only to unions, working-class people, government employees, and ignores the rest. He redistributes the wealth to his supporters, all during the worst economic crisis since 1929. That's why it's easy to distract. The people are frightened. As Rahm Emanuel, White House Chief of Staff, said, never let a great crisis go wasted. Obama is doing a stand-up routine in front of the White House while his cronies take all the furniture and the money out the back. Obama is America's Hugo Chavez.
Thanks, Wayne. They keep the distractions going. That's why we try to keep our eyes on the ball. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.